we're having today for the Mises Institute Oral History Project, we're interviewing the distinguished historian of classical liberalism, Ralph Rako, who was the closest associate of Murray Rothbard. And we're going to ask him a number of questions about his early life and career. And Ralph, I'd like to start off by asking, I believe you were born in the Bronx. Can you tell us something about what it was like growing up there?
Well, no, I wasn't. I wasn't born in the Bronx. I was born in what was then Italian Harlem, now Spanish Harlem. And David, you must know this. Archbishop Usher in the 17th century.
Oh, yes.
Right. He dated the creation of the world from October 23rd, 4004 B.C. Well, I don't know about the 4004 B.C., but that October 23rd, I think, is very auspicious. I was born on October 23rd, 1936, on 107th Street in Italian Harlem. Very soon, my parents made a couple of real good decisions. My Italian relatives were fine people, basically working people. Some of them owned small shops, but very warm-hearted people. But nonetheless, when I was very young, we moved up to the Bronx. And that was a whole different world. The first good thing my parents did was put me in the public schools, not parochial schools. I don't think I would have been very happy with those tough Irish kids who knew how to use their fists and so on. It was much better being in the public schools where everybody was Jewish. Well, not some of the old tenured teachers who were Irish or German, but all my friends were Jewish. And where we lived in the Bronx, also in my apartment building, there was only one other non-Jewish family. That was the Greeks, the Athos family next door. Very nice people. But everybody else was Jewish. Down on the fourth floor, this is a bit of an interesting anecdote. Most of them were just FDR lovers. But there were some Norman Thomas socialists, and on the fourth floor, in 4B, Mrs. Sherovitz, who was a communist. Her husband belonged to the Furriers Union. And very early on, in my early teens, I started to get, as I'll explain, certain political views. And I also wanted to spread my views, so I sent a letter to, I think it was the Daily News, where I said that Joseph Stalin had been a bank robber. Well, yeah, everybody knows that. He was collecting funds for the Bolsheviks in the Caucasus in Georgia. But so my mother showed this around, this letter to the editor, wonderful and so on, but Mrs. Sherovitz got very angry, and she said, you know, Stalin could sue you for that. And I panicked. If Stalin sues me, my father's going to kill me. How am I going to get an attorney? You know, well, it turned out Stalin didn't sue me. But this is an indication. As I say, most of them were just Roosevelt lovers, but they were there was some really quite nice people. So growing up in the Bronx, yes, all my friends were Jewish. Some of them were real smart. In junior high, my best friend was Leon Levy. And he must, I don't know what age you are, maybe 14 or something. Anyway, in his room behind his desk, he had the periodic table of the elements. He was very, very much into chemistry. Turned out to be, as I learned in later years, a geologist down in Texas. But very smart kids, some of them were. Now, let's talk about my political influences and so on. My father used to bring home the Journal American, a big Hearst newspaper. We also saw the Daily News. They had this, in those days, great isolationist political, the Washington correspondent, John O'Donnell. We've got the Daily Mirror also. Anyway, pretty much right wing. And on the radio, I started to listen to Fulton Lewis Jr. He had a 15-minute program every weekday, and very strongly anti-communist. So that was basically my orientation. And somehow, I forget how, I heard about Hayek's Road to Serfdom. So I read that, and that opened up a lot of doors for me. In those days, before I was corrected, I pronounced it Hayek. Things went along, a lot of political activity. In 1952, I was the head of Students for Taft in New York City. It was not a large organization. But one thing that came of it was that one day at our headquarters, I forget some hotel downtown, the General Taft headquarters, Leonard Liggio showed up. And that was the start of a friendship that goes on to this day. Leonard has been very influential in my life. And also I met George Reisman, because George had set up a bridge table outside of the public library on 42nd Street, collecting signatures and distributing pamphlets and leaflets for Taft. So I went over to it one time, and there was something about the way I came over, because the first thing that George said to me was, "What's on your small mind?" But we became good friends, and good friends at Bronx Science. Leonard Liggio went on to college in Georgetown, but George and I were buddies for quite a while. And I was heavily into my letter writing period, so I wrote a letter to this little magazine that I think was put out by the Chamber of Commerce called USA. And I mentioned, because George had introduced me to Mises. George had read Human Action by that time, whenever he was 14, 15 or something. And so I mentioned Mises, and somehow, they must have a clipping service or something, they found out about this up at FEE, at the Foundation for Economic Education. I got a letter from them, and they invited me, and I think I mentioned George also, to come up, and we were sort of poster boys at their annual board of directors or board of trustees meeting. I met. I was pretty impressed. Some big businessmen. There's Jasper Crane from DuPont, I think, and some others. But also, I met the people of FEE in those days. A very different organization, I think, now. But there was Leonard Reed. There was Paul Perot, Ivan Bierley, F.A. Harper. F.A. Harper was the first one I'd ever come across who was who had Murray's point of view, which will, I guess, I'll bring up in a few minutes. Let's call it the totally voluntary society. If you get my drift. And F.A. Harper was universally known as Baldy Harper, not because he was bald. His brother was bald. For some reason, he was called Baldy. One of the mysteries. But the great thing that happened was that Leonard Reed or somebody suggested or sent a letter to Ludwig von Mises. Now, George and I, a couple of years before that, had found out where Mises lived. Did I ever tell you this? It's one of the most embarrassing things that ever happened.
One of the great stories.
Yeah. And we went up to Mises' apartment. He came to the door. He was dressed in a tuxedo, except for his bow tie. And we asked him whether he wanted to buy a subscription to the Freeman, which the fee was putting out. And he said, the Freeman? I already have the Freeman. And he closed the door. And George and I went out of the apartment. We didn't make any eye contact. And that was that. But this time, we were invited guests at the Mises seminar at NYU. And Mises, of course, was not a tenured professor at NYU. All they did was give him the room. His salary was paid by the Volcker Fund, just as with Hayek, never a tenured professor in the economics department. His salary was paid by outside organizations also. Sometimes I've given in some of my talks, student groups at the Mises Institute ask them, you know your professors, you know about professors. Could you imagine Hayek and Mises not being tenured? And they look a little stunned. Well, down at Mises seminar, met a lot of people, and the main one was Murray Rothbard.
One question I had was, it appears that although the dominant culture when you were growing up, it was very left-wing, you started being interested in more classical, liberal, and conservative views quite early on. What do you think accounted for your reaction against the predominant views?
As I say, the Jewish, the subculture, basically the culture in New York and in the Bronx in those days, was quite left-wing, but not in my family. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, was a Republican. I think because his best years were in the business wise were in the 20s. But anyway, there were no leftists in my own family. I didn't get that. I was sort of immunized against that. And then all of these other sources, the papers I read, and the radio broadcasts, and so on. But that meeting with Murray at the Mises seminar was decisive. I mean, it's most Murray is the greatest intellectual influence in my life. And we went out for coffee afterwards, and I started to get an idea that that Murray was a, but you really couldn't call him a conservative or what is he exactly? We expressed our appreciation of Mises, and Murray said, "Ah, yes, Mises is a great man, the greatest economist of all time. But some of us refer to I got the idea. This guy is somebody really different and special and extremely interesting. He really was. You guys knew Murray to an extent. You know what I'm talking about. He was fantastically well-read. His library, you know, thousands and thousands of books. I think it's part of the library down in Auburn now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes. His wife Joey, she was his absolutely perfect wife, and she was so generous as a hostess to us. We spent endless nights up to Joey would finally go to bed, but up to 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Murray talking about everything. Murray would jump up and get one of his books and read us a passage from it. He read us a lot of Mencken, by the way. That's the first time I'd ever come across Mencken. But we did. We went to movies together. Oh, I should mention that it wasn't just George and me, but Leonard Liggio also very often came around. A few other people, Bob Hessen, for a while, and we would do other things: go to movies, play board games. The favorite board game was Risk. It was taking over. You had to try to take over the world, and. Murray was constantly giving advice to other players, really disinformation, how to attack someone else and so on. But also Ron Hamaway was an important part of the group. And we spent a lot of time socializing all the time. And as I say, Joey was a terrific hostess. Typical of us, or at least me, being a kid and all, never crossed my mind to bring a bottle of wine or anything. But water off a duck's back to them. This was what we call the Circle Bastiat. I see that on the Mises.org webpage, Danny Sanchez has a column where he talks, where he uses the phrase Circle Bastiat. By the way, that's one of the few pictures, one of the few photos, if anybody ever bothers to visit that website, that logo is one of the few photos that was ever taken of all of us. Joey took it, and if anybody wonders, the person on the extreme right there, whose face is half cut off, is Leonard, because he was the tallest of us. She was a great woman, not the greatest photographer. Let's see now. When George and I entered college, he was at Columbia, I was at City College. And we started a very intensive study of German, of the German language. You know that Hans Hoppe gets a kick out of this. You know this P.J. O'Rourke?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, he's a neocon. He's very popular at the Cato Institute. And he said that, he's written, that German is a language that's designed to enable you to spit into the face of the person you're talking to. Hans thought that was funny. But we studied a German master, that I would say, because right away, George got a grant from the Volcker Fund to translate Mises' books on a book on epistemological problems of economics, and also another history book that Mises thought was important. I got a grant to translate Mises' book on liberalism. And that book has come on by a number of different titles. It was finally published, I think, in 67, but it's never been out of print. And that got me into a closer relationship with Mises, because I talked over his book and from time to time. And also, it was a feather in my cap when I started applying for positions as a college instructor. But meanwhile, a couple of things happened while I was in grad school at Chicago. We set up a magazine called New Individualist Review, NIR, and Friedman was a faculty advisor. We had a couple of other faculty advisors, Ben Rogge from Wabash, Stigler, and we didn't need very much money, but Friedman was able to raise what we needed among some businessmen in Chicago. It was very easy for him. And there was about a 4 or 5 year run of the magazine. I see that Liberty Fund has bought up the copyright to the magazine, but it's now it's available in hardcover and available from Liberty Fund. And we got some very good articles. Well, the first article of the first issue was by Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom. It became then the name of a book of his. And Hayek wrote for us. I see that Armin Alshin has just passed away. Alshin wrote for us, Demsetz, many other people. And so that was something that I was involved with very closely while in grad school. Another thing that happened was back in New York, and that was the split between Murray and Ayn Rand. I'd met Ayn a few times at her apartment, through Murray, whom she was looking to groom as a member of what they called the collective. That was a kind of Randian joke. It was as good a joke as the Randians ever made. But and Murray was very enthusiastic about Ayn. And Ayn was a brilliant woman. Certainly the most brilliant woman I've ever met. One of the most brilliant people. However, she was, I would say, seduced or corrupted by her later followers. In her earlier career, her friends were people like Henry Hazlitt, Leonard Reed, Rose Wilder Lane, people who were, to some degree anyway, her equal. Afterwards, after Fountainhead came out, I think, she gathered together, or they gathered around her, a group of Canadians. Nathaniel Brandon, his wife, Barbara Brandon, Peacock, the people who run the Ayn Rand Institute now, that is Peacock. They were simply gushing acolytes. So she didn't hang out with her former friends, and she was surrounded by these people. And I think that's what finally led to bad things in her life. For one thing, it led to this ridiculous affair with Nathaniel Brandon, who afterwards true to his inner self and his inner Tad. he downplayed by saying that she was old enough to be his mother, so that naturally he had to break off and go with a younger woman. That's the way those people were. I remember one time. There was one time when Ayn came down to the Mises seminar, and it was really very heartwarming. Mises was giving one of his lectures, and then he started talking about the importance of spreading our ideas through literature. And he said, and I mention this because we have in our company tonight a great novelist who has, Atlas had come out by that time, who has in fact spread our ideas to many, many thousands of people. And I was sitting right next to Ayn, and she was all smiles. She was glowing. She loved flattery. She was like a little girl, really. And it was very sweet to see. Murray finally had to break with Brandon. The arrogance of those people. Some of us were in what was referred to as therapy by Brandon. He was a psychotherapist. He had a degree in education, I think. Talked about personal things. I had the suspicion that actually Brandon was communicating some of these personal things to Ayn and perhaps to others, but I never actually found out about that. But Brandon confronted Murray one time and said that he had to divorce Joey. Why did he have to divorce Joey? Well, it's obvious. She's a Christian. She believes she's a mystic. She was a loving woman. She was a very intelligent woman, a very bright woman, she was the love of Murray's life. And he was not going to give her up for a group of bozos. So that was then that, and we all had to take our stand either with Murray or with the Randians. And George Reisman and Bob Hessen went with the Randians, and I and the others in the Circle of Basquiat, Ron Hamaway and Leonard went with the Murray. By the way, those times when we went up to Ayn's place to chat with her and converse with her. I remember one time she went into some big thing about the need for having a basis in metaphysics and epistemology and so on before you can argue that the post office should be privatized. And Leonard just went to sleep. That was a survival mechanism he had. Her husband, Frank O'Connor, was the best of as far as a human being goes, was the best of the group. He did some amateur painting, and some of his paintings and drawings were up on the wall in their apartment. And one of the Ranroids, who was an art history major or something, had verbally at one point said that this particular sketch, this watercolor by Frank, reminds her of the young Michelangelo, and that's the kind of people they were. Well, I was looking this over from that point of view, and Frank was there, and I said, Frank, is there something wrong with the perspective? Oh, by the way, of course, it was skyscrapers. I forgot to mention that. And so I said, is there something wrong with it? And he said, yeah, it probably is. He was a very easygoing guy. That's the way he got along with Ayn, I think. loved her. They'd met out in Hollywood, I think, when she was a wardrobe consultant. I think he was a part-time actor. He'd been very good-looking when he was a young man. And I think that was a model of her heroes in her novels. They were all handsome-looking wasp types. Anyway, by that time, when the split with the Randians came, I was in Chicago. So I was back in Chicago. So it didn't really affect me.
Can you say something about Hayek and your relationship with him at Chicago? And
Sure. He was the head of my dissertation committee, so I saw him from time to time. But and also I had some tutorials with him. That the Committee on Social Thought had a system that they called having tutorials on particular books with particular members of their staff. Hayek once frankly told me the only reason he taught was so that he could have an income to do his research. He had very little interest in teaching, or really very little interest in students. He was always polite, super polite, a gentleman, an Austrian aristocrat, really, and of course an immensely learned man. I have disagreements with him on the history and thought, the history of thought and other issues, but doesn't take away in the least from his greatness. Mises, on the other hand, loved students. That's why he would go out for coffee very often afterwards with them. Students who were bright and who were interested in his work. And he was always extremely friendly, always extremely accessible. So at anything that we might bring up, I remember one time I'd known Murray for a while and absorbed some of his ideas, and I said, "What do you think about Murray's idea about competing courts and police departments and so on?" And he said, "Rothbard, he's for everything that's against the government." Mises never wanted to get into that issue, although it came up one time at the seminar, but he wasn't really very open to the idea of a totally voluntary society. My college career. My first job was at Wabash College in Indiana. Ben Rogge got me a position there as an instructor. And it was in Crawfordsville, Indiana. In those days, for all I know, even today, a town of 12,000 people. Before I lived in Crawfordsville, the smallest city I'd ever lived in was Paris. In Crawfordsville, they sold, I swear, they sold olive oil in the pharmacy. It was a cure for earaches. So it was not exactly my place, but my sort of place. But my friend Bruce Goldberg was teaching at Champaign, Urbana at the time, not very far away across the border in Illinois. And so we got together quite often with his new wife, Gabriella von Natzma, I think was her maiden name. A German woman, wonderful. I'm still in touch with her from time to time, although Bruce is gone. Sharp. So that was partially a compensation for living in Crawfordsville. And the students, it was an all-boys school. It still is. I think it's the only all-boys school in the country. But they were very bright kids, most of them. They were going to be doctors and lawyers and take over their dad's business when the time came and so on. So from that point of view, it was quite good. And it was my first teaching experience, so I learned a lot from that. But I still hadn't gotten through with my PhD. So after a few years, they let me go. And then I got down to it and finished it quite soon. But I got a job interview in Buffalo at Buffalo State College, or as they like to sometimes say, the State University of New York College at Buffalo, pretending that they're the University of Buffalo across the town. I'm long retired, but I taught there for a long time, whatever. What was it? 25, 30 years. It was a good time. And some of the students were okay, but not like the Wabash kids and not like the kids that I meet at the seminars of the Mises Institute. In the meantime, I did a lot of traveling and mostly paid for, well, never paid for by me, mostly paid for by foundations or by the people that invited me, all over the U.S., in Canada a few times also, but mainly in Europe, all over Europe. It was one of the best parts of my life, really. I visited Poland, went down to Krakow, Warsaw, Gdansk, as they call it now, and Russia. That was funded by the Cato Institute. I gave a talk in Moscow, and then went to Leningrad, and met a couple of Russian students. The communist educational system was terrible from the ideological point of view, but otherwise it was excellent. Their English was better than the English of my students back in Buffalo. And the two boys, Yuri and Igor, and they were showing off a little. One was maintaining that Hemingway was greater than Faulkner. The other was saying Faulkner was greater. Can imagine that my students arguing about something like that. So in Russia, all over Germany, went to Scandinavia. I see that the Cafe Hyatt has an old talk of mine that I gave on the Industrial Revolution in Stockholm back in whatever early 2000. What I remember from Stockholm is they like herring a lot. They really like herring. I had to, if you can believe this, I had to take a plane down to Germany to get a decent meal. I've traveled all over Germany, Berlin a number of times. I traveled to Cologne. That was at the invitation of a professor I'd somehow come across, I forget how, Professor Christian Vatrin, and I addressed his seminar and gave, in fact, a number of talks there. That was the genesis of my book on German liberalism that Dieter Hülsmann then translated into German. I think, yes, it was at Cologne at some point that I met Guido, who, as I don't have to tell you, is simply amazing. He teaches at a French university now. He lectures in French. German is his native language. English is his third language, and it's absolutely flawless. Besides everything else, I mean, his great skill as an analyst. Traveled, let's see, as far as traveling goes, in Italy, a lot, many times in got any further south than Rome, never visited my ancestral stamping grounds in Calabria, Naples, Sicily. But Italy was wonderful. Well, much of it could be said, of course. In Spain, also, I took some time. I was giving a talk in Mallorca, off the coast, off the Mediterranean coast. So it was paid by some foundation or other. But I stopped off at Barcelona to see the Gaudí buildings. He was the great architect of Barcelona. That was memorable. Actually, there was Vienna, of course, many times. I didn't get to go along on the a trip that the Mises Institute took to Vienna. When was that?
Well, there have been two of them. One, the one most recently last year.
So we were late 1990s.
Well, the first one was in the late 1980s.
Oh, uh huh.
And the second one was 2011.
I think 2011.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. But I'd visited Vienna. I visited Vienna a number of times. Had some friends there. As I said somewhere or other, I just heard myself saying it, and I think maybe at one of the Mises Institute lectures. This was the Vienna of Mises and Hayek and the great composers and so on. But by the time I visited, it was very different. Socialists had come in and they threw out the aristocrats. Then the Nazis came in and they threw out the Jews. And what you see in Vienna now is what's left. Not very much. But the traveling, I never went to the Far East. It was too far. And Latin America never interested me at all, really. Traveling in Europe was a great experience. I can hardly go down to the store nowadays with my rheumatism and so on. So I'm not going to be traveling to Europe anymore, but I remember it. And maybe I should say a few things about my connection with the Mises Institute.
Please, yes.
Yes. Well, now, you have to verify this, Lou. I am not on the Institute payroll, am I?
You're not.
Right, okay. And your books are open to anybody who wants to check that, right?
Yes.
Okay, the Mises Institute is, let me just put it this way. It's Murray's dream come true. Too much about it and about Lou and about the staff and about the people who work there. Now, with I think Chad Parrish is in charge of your technological outreach.
He is. He's responsible for this session today, in fact.
Is that right? Well, he's done a fantastic job. I mean, audio and video presentations that go out across the world. Tens of thousands of people seeing it all the time. You're supporting great scholars. I mean, Hans is just one of the people that you've Hans Hoppe, just one of the people you've nurtured. Joe Salerno, Guido, of course, David also, and so on. So it's Murray's dream come true, and it is in a number of senses, in the sense that it is totally dedicated to the totally voluntary society. Nudge, nudge. college. and beyond that, dedicated to the non-aggression principle. Now, because of the personnel at the Mises Institute, and Murray would have been totally in sympathy with this, I think that there's a strong inclination towards Christianity and Christian morality. And as long as there's the non-aggression principle, I have no problem with that myself personally. But Murray, I think, would have been very sympathetic to that. Any last questions?
Tell us about your doctoral dissertation, speaking of Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Yes, this question of the connection of liberty and Christianity was on my mind for a long time, and it came out in my doctoral dissertation. It was on the Committee on Social Thought, and I studied the thought of three liberal thinkers, Benjamin Constant, Alexis de Tocqueville, and Lord Acton. Constant was a deist, but very sympathetic to Christianity. Tocqueville was extremely sympathetic to Christianity, although there's evidence that he was actually an agnostic. But Lord Acton, of course, was a great Catholic historian. So that was the general theme of the dissertation, and allowed me to get into into the thought of these men to a very great extent. When I started out, David will know this. There's a famous history of political thought by George Sabine.
Oh yes, yes, right. It came out in around 31.
It was a classic in its time, and Benjamin Constant was not even mentioned. Nobody mentioned Constant in the English-speaking world. I mean, it's part of the parochialism of Anglo-Saxons. So I was one of the first people, really, to get into Constant to a large extent. Constant is still my favorite 19th-century liberal. Hayek said that Tocqueville and Acton were his favorite 19th-century liberals, but that's Hayek, and as far as I'm concerned, a mistake. But Constant was terrific all the way through.
Ralph, you mentioned Bruce Goldberg. Isn't it right that you converted Bruce Goldberg to libertarianism?
Yeah. Well, I did. Actually, I introduced him to libertarian ideas. The one who converted him was Murray, because Bruce came down to the Servo Basiat meetings at Murray's place, and they talked on and on, and Bruce raised his questions, and Murray answered them. And it was Bruce who then went on to Princeton grad school, and I went out to Chicago. And at Princeton, Bruce met Bob Nozick. And Nozick, I think I have a little piece on that that's in my archive at lewrockwell.com on what happened with Bob Nozick. Bruce and Bob became great friends at Princeton, and Bob read everything anybody suggested that he thought might be interesting, and so Bob started reading libertarian works and became a libertarian for a while. Afterwards, I think he had some second thoughts. He was basically a free enterprise man throughout his life, throughout his unfortunately short life. He was a libertarian for a while. Bruce also converted temporarily another grad student at Princeton. That was George Will. But George Will went on to study at Oxford and was seduced by the whole Tory business, and wrote a book called Statecraft as Soulcraft. you two probably hear the echoes of Bob Nozick was also obviously a very interesting and I guess philosophically important and influential man.
IHS was a great institution, and you were you were long time associated with them. What led to the your disassociation from them?
What was my?
Yeah, why did you kind of move away from the IHS?
I didn't really. My connection at IHS was Leonard Liggio.
Okay.
No, really, I'm used to the place now. Anything else come up?
One thing, is this right, you were influenced quite a bit by Paul Goodman. Could you tell us a bit about him?
Well, yeah, that was a mistake, unfortunately. I think he called himself a Tory anarchist. Anyway, his political views were quite attractive, and I went through a phase where I believed in liberation and in the Goodman-esque sense. But who sponsored it. It was some other foundation where a bunch of speakers, Tom Soss was there, Paul Goodman, some others, myself, and I got to know him a little better personally, and I came to the conclusion that he was kind of phony. So that was, as I say, a mistake.
One other question. A great many of your writings, you've done very important work in revisionist history. Could you say something about how you became acquainted with that?
My interest in revisionism, that is, revising the government's line about how we got into wars, how we conducted wars, the aftermath of wars, and so on. And Murray introduced me to that. He was a big revisionist in that sense. The first book that Mises Institute published of mine, Great Wars and Great Leaders, A Libertarian Rebuttal, is basically a revisionist work, and it's dedicated to Murray for that reason, and I have a little introduction there about Murray and revisionist history. If we didn't have revisionism, we'd still believe that the USS Maine was in Havana Harbor on a goodwill tour, was blown up by the vicious Spaniards, that Lincoln went to war to invaded the South to free the slaves, that Woodrow Wilson was loved peace, that Franklin Roosevelt spent every day and night toiling ceaselessly for peace. That's the sort of stuff we'd believe if we didn't have revisionism. So I think another reason Murray would love the work of the Mises Institute is because of their interest in revisionism. Anything else come up?
Could you talk a little bit about the relationship at Chicago between Friedman and Hayek and the rest of the economics department?
Yeah, well, as I say, Hayek was always punctilious in his politeness. So they were very civil to each other. I don't think they had very much to do with each other socially. you know, about Friedman and Stiglitz didn't think that Hayek was a real economist. I don't know what they thought he was. A raconteur or something. but of course, every year, whenever the Nobel Prizes are given out, the University of Chicago gets a full page ad in the New York Times, lists all the Nobel laureates and all the different disciplines that are connected with Chicago, and they list Hayek also, giving the impression that Hayek had something to do with the economics department, although he was purely on the Committee on Social Thought. So I don't think that they Hayek had much to do with anybody in the economics department. The last time I saw Hayek was in Freiburg, where he, I think, still having money problems or money issues, went to teach after he retired from the Committee on Social Thought. And I think I was with Bruce Goldberg at the time. We were spending some time in Freiburg. And it was interesting. I don't remember too much of the conversation. I had told some anecdotes. We chatted a bit. We had Pfannkuchen, which is a really great German pancake, which is the main thing that sticks in my mind. That's as far as Hayek goes.
Did you ever attend personally?
Anyway, let me say that. The Cato Institute. You know, I was vice president of the Cato Institute when it was set up in San Francisco.
I didn't know that.
And Murray was their chief theoretician. That was before they moved to Washington and wanted to get in with the establishment, and Murray was finally was kicked out, and I didn't have anything more to do with them. But it's typical. They have a great modernistic new building in Washington, and the great lecture hall where it seats, I don't know, hundreds of people, is called the Hayek Hall. They would never name anything after Mises. Mises was too controversial. Of course, it doesn't bother them that Hayek and the Constitution of Liberty is, as Hans says, practically indistinguishable from a social democrat. He's in favor of one welfare measure after the other, even government housing.
Ralph, this was magnificent.
Well, I hope that I sounded okay.
That sounded great.
That it worked out okay. And thanks for the opportunity to make myself immortal. Take care.
Thank you, Ralph.
Bye, Ralph.